It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's dairy industry relies heavily on immigrant labor. A new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at the history behind Wisconsin's immigrant workforce.
First, a new report from the Washington Post and 60 Minutes takes a hard look at a bill that was passed in April of 2016 that effectively stripped the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, of its power to go after prescription drug distributors.
The report says that a handful of congresspeople worked with some of the nation's biggest prescription drug lobbyists to persuade the DEA and the Justice Department to agree to a more industry-friendly law. These efforts came during the height of the opioid epidemic. Here's a clip from a Washington Post video featuring Joseph Ranazizi, who formerly ran the DEA's division responsible for regulating the drug industry.
It watered down DEA's authority to go after wholesalers, manufacturers, distributors, and it weakened their authority to go after pharmacies.
Our next guest says the story is just one part of the wider problem of opioid addiction. Dr. Caleb Alexander is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. Dr. Alexander, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a lot of parts to the story of the opioid epidemic, but what do you make of this particular report on this bill, the Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act, related to the distributors of pharmaceuticals?
Well, I think many people have found it quite shocking, frankly, and I think many people weren't aware of the nature of the bill or the way that it undermined one of the Drug Enforcement Agency's key functions, which is to conduct surveillance of drug wholesalers that are moving pharmaceutical products from manufacturers to pharmacies and to intervene when they see suspicious activity. And I think that a lot of people have expressed concern since this report came out about the ways that this may really hobble the DEA's function.
Now, these are prescription drugs, opioid medications. What was going on here was some pharmacies, some suppliers were getting a lot of these medications through these distributors. The DEA wanted the distributors to help figure out who was getting too many drugs, look at suspicious activity. How important a part of the overall story of opioid drugs was this one angle?
Well, it's a really important one. You know, I think that there is a small proportion of prescribers and of pharmacies that account for a large proportion of opioids in circulation. And I wouldn't want for listeners to think that the opioid epidemic is just a problem of pill mills and what are called rogue prescribers, that is, prescribers that are practicing way outside of the you know, normal practice of medicine. But there are prescribers like that, and there are pill mills. These are typically settings where prescribers may be seeing up to 100 or 200 patients per day, often prescribing medicines without doing physical exams, without keeping proper records, and clearly violating the best standards of clinical care. So it is vital that the DEA have the opportunity to and the enforcement ability to go after these pill mills and rogue prescribers when they are identified.
Big picture, this opioid epidemic has been building a long time. Where are we right now? Are we still on the rise? Are things still getting worse in the country?
Well, I wish I had better news for you. This is an epidemic that's been really hidden in plain sight for 2 decades. And incredibly, more people died in 2015 than ever before. And the CDC has come out with preliminary estimates for 2016, and they're worse yet. So an estimated 64,000 Americans succumbing from drug overdoses. Prescription opioids are just one part of that. And many people are also dying from heroin and illicit fentanyl. So incredibly, despite the widespread attention that the epidemic rightly gets and deserves, the estimates are that more people will die in 2017 than in 2016. It's a massive problem, and it's a very complex problem. And so it will take a while to really turn this steamship around.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, looking at the opioid epidemic after a Washington Post 60 Minutes expose that came out last night. As you say, it's a complicated problem, Dr. Alexander, and you point toward a number of different stakeholders, each of whom can take an action that can help. Let's start with the drug manufacturers themselves. What could be their contribution to solving the problem?
Well, I think that many people point to manufacturers because, indeed, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, opioids were marketed and promoted for the treatment of chronic non-cancer pain, things like lower back pain, fibromyalgia, chronic headaches. And unfortunately, what we've learned the hard way is that the evidence supporting the use of opioids in this setting is really thin. That is, we've tended to overestimate the effectiveness of opioids for these types of pain and also underestimate their risks. So I think that one of the important things that the manufacturers can do in concert with the FDA is to pull back on advertising that markets and promotes opioids for the treatment of non-cancer pain, where so many injuries and deaths have occurred.
Let's take it to the doctors now. They're the ones in the room with the patient, maybe a patient who's suffering and in pain and wants the medication either for the pain or for their addiction, in effect, to avoid the withdrawal symptoms. What can doctors do to help with this?
Well, I think there are two different issues here. So the first is that the treatment of chronic pain, and there are lots and lots of tools in the toolbox. I'm a general internist, and like so many doctors, I think that we've tended to reach for opioids far too early. And when I was in training in the late 1990s, I can remember having been taught that if a patient had what was called at the time true pain or legitimate pain, quote unquote, that one need not have to worry about the addictive potential of opioids. And nothing could be further from the truth. And unfortunately, I was part of a whole generation of professionals that was taught as such. So I think the first thing that healthcare professionals need to keep in mind is that there are many tools in the toolbox and that there are many alternative prescription drugs as well as many non-drug therapies that can be used. But the second part of your question had to do with patients that may have an opioid use disorder, that is, who may have addiction. And unfortunately, more than 2 million Americans are estimated to have an opioid use disorder. And the majority of these haven't been diagnosed. That is, they and their providers haven't identified that they are addicted to opioids or have an opioid use disorder. So I think it's imperative that prescribers and patients improve screening to identify these patients and connect them with treatment, because we know that there is evidence-based treatment out there and that people lead very rewarding, successful lives in recovery after having experienced opioid addiction.
What's the state of insurance coverage for different types of pain treatment?
Well, it's a great question. I think deservedly there's a brighter and brighter light that's shining on insurance coverage. And the reason why is because if these types of treatments, that is alternatives to opioids, aren't covered well by insurance, people aren't going to use them. So understandably, these days, everyone is focused on opioids, and rightly so, because so many people are getting injured or dying or developing addiction from long-term use of opioids. But while we're doing so, we also need to remember that the coverage and reimbursement policies for alternatives to opioids make a big difference in ultimately the care that people will seek.
What are some of the alternatives to opioids? What can a doctor reach for in their toolkit instead of that prescription?
Well, incredibly, the first most oftentimes the first best thing to reach for are treatments that are over the counter. So I have dozens of patients that come to me with musculoskeletal pain, most commonly lower back pain, but also hip arthritis or knee arthritis, sometimes other types of chronic non-cancer pain, who are well controlled with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or sometimes we call those NSAIDs, things like ibuprofen or naproxen. Acetaminophen or Tylenol also works very well for many patients. But there are many other prescription medicines that can be used as well, not just over-the-counter, but prescription medicines that we can use for different types of pain. So, for example, some antidepressants are also effective for treating what's called neuropathic pain, pain that's caused by a problem with the nerves. So, for example, patients with diabetes that may have what's called diabetic neuropathy can be treated successfully with these types of medicines.
a reaction sometimes from people, I think, who might have chronic pain would be, you're telling me I need an antidepressant means you're telling me my pain is all in my head. It's fake pain.
Well, yeah, nothing could be further from the truth. And there's no question that there may be some stigma associated with the use of, for example, an antidepressant. But these are medicines that have been studied rigorously and where there's good scientific evidence that they're effective in treating the type of pain that I'm talking about, neuropathic pain, for example. I think one really important message for people to understand is that there's no conflict between our reducing or overuse of prescription opioids and improving the quality of care for people in pain. I think sometimes people tend to think that there's a necessary loss here. That is, there's no winning solution. Either you peel back the opioids and then patients suffer, or you continue opioids and then there's a risk of overdose. And the answer is, these two are not in conflict in many, many cases. So I think there are a lot of opportunities for us to improve quality of care, all the while reducing our over-reliance on prescription opioids.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. We're looking at the opioid epidemic in the United States after a Washington Post 60 Minutes report showed the ties between Congress and drug distributors and their lobbyists.
And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. How has the opioid epidemic touched your life? What's your take on this new report? And what do you think should be done to address this nationwide crisis? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, get to your calls in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're picking up our discussion now with Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. We're looking at the opioid epidemic after a new report shows Congress weakened the DEA's ability to go after drug distributors.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this story part of your life? Has someone close to you become addicted to opioids? How has this crisis affected your life, your community, your practice, if you're in healthcare yourself? What should we do about it as a nation, as a medical system, as patients, parents, neighbors? What's your reaction to the latest news? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Steve in Plainfield. Steve, we just lost Steve. We'll get to other callers in just a bit at 800-642-1234. Dr. Alexander, I wanted to talk a little bit about addiction treatment. We hear about methadone and other medications that help people deal with symptoms of withdrawal. And we hear sometimes, including from the 12-step movement, you're just replacing one addiction with another. Can you speak to that issue?
Yeah, well, there's no question that addiction is a brain disease, and we know that treatments such as methadone and buprenorphine are effective when they're administered to patients. They improve the ability of patients to resume healthy, rewarding, productive lives and integrate within their communities, and they also, importantly, decrease the risk of overdose death. So, I don't think many addiction experts would argue against someone also using other approaches, and there are patients that successfully pursue 12-step programs or other programs, but I think the most important message is that treatments such as buprenorphine or methadone are evidence-based, and they have remarkable success rates in terms of allowing for people to live healthy, fulfilling lives in recovery.
We'll go to our callers now. Jamie is with us in Green Bay. Jamie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Jamie?
So I just wanted to mention my experience with the use of opioids and morphines. I currently have 16 months sober, and it was a long road to recovery, but now I found that I cannot handle pain, and I avoid situations where I would be introduced to pain.
Are you worried, Jamie, that pain would be an incentive to go back to using a drug?
Right, exactly. And yeah, I'm not sure of any alternatives to that.
Well, this is something that I think is not uncommon. And, Jamie, thank you for sharing your experience. And many, many patients living in recovery struggle with that question. You know, for example, if they were to undergo surgery or experience some medical illness that caused pain, how would that optimally be managed? And the good news is that I think that healthcare professionals are increasingly aware of and trained to help manage pain in ways that avoid the need for opioids. So, you know, I think that the most important thing that I hear from your story is your willingness, you're having made a diagnosis, if you will, and you're having built up some time and living in recovery. And so I think, unfortunately, the majority of patients with opioid use disorders are still out there and haven't done so yet. So thank you for sharing your experience.
Jamie, thanks. Congratulations on 16 months and good luck down the road, too. We'll go next to Jason in Fort Atkinson. Jason, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share. In 2009, I had back surgery. The only reason I was able to have back surgery is because I was going to a methadone clinic. Without the methadone clinic, I don't know where I would be today. And there aren't a lot of them. I think that if we want to solve this, you know, opioid addiction with everybody, we need to give people more opportunities to get better.
Jason, thank you so much. Good luck to you as well, Jason. And Dr. Alexander, and we hear in Wisconsin, there are no methadone clinics. I think this is still true in the northern half of the state. This is a pretty big state. What do you think about access to methadone and the other treatments like that?
Well, it's a huge issue, and I suppose the silver lining here is that there is bipartisan support for expanding access and the quality of care that's delivered within recovery services. And so I expect continued emphasis on this, and I think the more that state and federal lawmakers and policymakers can be aware of stories such as those that we've heard, the better off we'll be with respect to the investments being made that we need to be sure are made to shore up our treatment system.
Thanks for the call, Jason. We're talking to Dr. Caleb Alexander from the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, looking at the opioid epidemic in the United States. Back to your calls now. Travis is on the line in Edgerton. Travis, hi.
Hi. So in the past 5 years, I've known more than a handful of people who have overdosed and passed away from heroin overdoses. I had one friend who we were trying to help. He was struggling with a heroin addiction. He came and stayed at our house for a while, and he was going through pretty severe withdrawals. He was unemployed and uninsured. We tried to help him find treatment through healthcare systems, and we found it really difficult to find a place that would take him without health insurance. I think it seems like it's really hard for people who want help and need help to get out there and like find treatment at low or no cost.
Thank you for sharing, and I'm sorry for your losses, Travis. And unfortunately, your experience is not that uncommon. And it's all the more reason that we need greater investments made in the treatment system and in shoring up the treatment system. You know, to be living with an opioid use disorder, as you know, having seen your friends, some of your friends, is difficult enough without the challenges that there are identifying high quality treatment services. And so, once again, I think the more that state policymakers, for example, in Wisconsin, are aware of this issue, the more they can go to bat and be sure for local communities that communities are being well served.
Travis, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Scott on the line in Whitewater. Scott, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say there is a silver lining to this crisis, and it's the fact that it's hitting white upper class citizens. Before this issue, it's been going on for decades. When it was black and brown people, it was a criminal enterprise, and it was treated as criminals. instead of having sick people that need help, we had crackheads. And I think that this country is finally going to move forward and seeing the general public seeing addiction as an illness and a sickness as far, and instead of being a crime.
Scott, thanks for the call. Dr. Alexander, are you seeing a change in the way we think of addiction in our society, maybe just because it's hitting a wider group of people now?
Well, I mean, there's still, unfortunately, so much stigma associated with addiction, and it is unfortunate. You know, I'm often asked about specific subgroups, racial, demographic, different sexes or ages that are affected by this epidemic. And while it's true that the greatest mortality rate, the greatest overdose rate has been among middle-aged whites, there's not a group in the country that hasn't been touched or one way or another by the epidemic, and that's one of the reasons that it's such a bipartisan issue. So I think it's thanks to programs such as yours and the conversations that I hope more and more Americans will have around the dinner table and within their churches and religious organizations and communities that some of the stigma can be combated and that people will recognize addiction is a brain disease. It's treatable, but it's also preventable. And primary prevention means that we need to reduce the use of prescription opioids for chronic non-cancer pain.
Dr. Alexander, before we wrap up, just briefly, you started us off with some bad news about the trends, the overdose numbers, the addiction numbers. Are you hopeful that maybe in a few years we might start to see that curve move the other way?
I am. And, you know, if you think about motor vehicle deaths during, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, there were astronomically high rates of injuries and deaths from motor vehicle accidents. And over the course of a century, we underwent a remarkable transformation where cars, vehicle safety is now incredibly high, even though, of course, accidents still occur. I think that we will turn the steamship around, but it's going to take a while. This has been 20 years or more in the making, and I think it's going to take us many more years until we get back to, you know, the rates of injury or death, which were still far too high, but much lower than the current period.
Thanks to Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. You can find more about Wisconsin's opioid epidemic at wiscontext.org.
Coming up after the news, we look at how and why Wisconsin's dairy industry is so reliant on immigrant labor.
This is Central Time.